NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Well, John, it is another episode of Flight Safety Detectives, except we're together. It's a rare event when you and I are together live, but we happen to be in Denver and, of course, in my office, and we are in cramped quarters. But you know what? There's worse things. So it's always good to be with you, and it's always good to have another episode of Flight Safety Detectives. We got, I think, a pretty good show to talk about, especially with the fact that there has been a recent accident involving a business aviation aircraft that killed 7 people out of 8. And we're going to talk about the process of what the NTSB is looking for. But to begin, John, we got to at least thank our sponsor, Avemco Insurance. They always come through for us. I've not only my airplane insured with Avemco, but I also, as a CFI, have CFI insurance, renter's insurance. So Avemco is a great sponsor for us. And if you listen to the show and you're looking for insurance, definitely mention that you are a member of the Flight Safety Detectives team, if you will, and they will give you a 5% discount. On top of that, we're always looking for making this show bigger and better. So we look for your support, and that support comes through subscriptions. Of course, it's always through your likes on the show, what you like, what you don't like. We try to take that feedback and improve the show. So please give us your clicks. Definitely share the information with others and get them to join, but be a subscriber to the show. One of the things that we got to do this weekend, John, is hang out in L.A. I, of course, belong to this little group called the Living Legends of Aviation. This is the time of year when we normally have our gala to honor not only new inductees and honorees for their accomplishments in aviation and aerospace, but it also gives an opportunity for the Kitty Hawk Foundation, basically to raise money for inspiring young people, and we're talking as young as kindergarten, to get involved in aviation and aerospace. So we had an opportunity to hang out at the Beverly Hilton Hotel with some of our friends, both known and unknown. And then I flew back with my friend Morgan Freeman, the actor, on his airplane. It is a Canadair Challenger, 601 Challenger. And it was ironic because flying back from L.A. yesterday to Denver, the weather was not the best. If people watch the football game here in Denver between the Patriots, which, given the fact that you're in Boston and Patriots won, you know, they're going to the Super Bowl.
That's why I'm here.
Yeah, you wanted to gloat in front of all of these Denver Bronco fans. But I did have an opportunity to fly back. And was talking to my friends who are the pilots of that aircraft. And we got talking about some of the issues involved with the Bombardier Challenger, the 601 series aircraft. I also worked probably four
Canadair Challenger accidents throughout my career, one involving Dick Ebersol when his son Charlie was killed in a 2004 accident out here in Colorado. And, you know, one of the things that we're going to be looking at as part of our show over the next couple of weeks is the investigative process, what the NTSB is going to be doing with this accident up in Bangor, Maine. As many of you know, the weather along the East Coast at the time that we're recording this show and the day before was just lousy. The airlines had canceled.
Everything was canceled.
Yeah, more than 10,000 flights really shut down the East Coast. Yet now up in Bangor, Maine, you have a business aircraft that likely stopped for fuel because the airplane is registered to a firm out of Houston. Supposedly they are heading or were heading to Europe. So that would have been a fuel stop for them before they continued on. No one else was flying that day. And unfortunately, this aircraft, in the attempt to take off out of Bangor, never made it really beyond the airport boundary. So the question is, what happened? Now, John, you and I have had the opportunity to talk off air about some of the issues that not only we as investigators would be looking at based on at least the current information, which there isn't much since the accident just happened, but we've had the opportunity to talk at what we would be looking at if we were doing the investigation.
Right. So right off the bat, as soon as you show up, you want to talk to the air traffic controllers. You want to talk to the people in the FBO, get their opinion on what conditions were like. We'll get ultimately we'll get it from the Weather Bureau, but we will we'll ask what everybody's opinion was, and also we'll talk about the pilots and the passengers if they came into the terminal, any conversations they had with them, all the in general things that you would do when you stop at a gas station someplace, essentially.
Yeah. The big thing here is because we know that the airplane, that the Challenger 600 series, because of the wing design, it's built for speed, if you will. It's a hard wing, so they don't have leading edge devices and things like that. It is very susceptible to ice and snow contamination, just like any other laminar flow type wing. So you really have to have a clean wing philosophy when it comes to operating that aircraft. One of the big issues that I would expect the NTSB and the FAA to really develop is, did they get the airplane de-iced? If so, what kind of de-icing fluid? Because as you know, there are different holdover times for the different types of de-icing fluid. If you have type one fluid, you literally have to shoot the airplane and then really take off because there is no holdover time versus type two, type three, type four. So again, that's the detail that the board will have to really ferret out to determine, did the airplane get de-iced?
And when.
That's the biggest thing. The time between de-icing and the attempt at takeoff. The other thing that I'm concerned about is contamination on the runway. Because of the snowfall rates up there, it's most likely that maybe the ramp may not have been plowed, but the runway, that's going to be of concern, because if there was any kind of contamination, especially slush, sleet, snow, and they were pushing that as they were trying to take off, of course, that's going to degrade the performance of the aircraft, really not allow the airplane to accelerate. And all of a sudden now there comes a point where you're starting to run out of runway. Do you try to make the airplane fly before it wants to fly? Or is there a combination of trying to make the airplane fly with a contaminated wing?
So that's an airport with pretty long runways. It's used by many, many, many both east and westbound flights to and from Europe for fuel stops and the U.S. military. I've seen B-52s in there. So it's a big airport. It's not something you think that's a small airport in northern Maine. But back to the conversations with all the people in the FBO, one of the things that he didn't mention was they will also want to look and listen to see if anyone had heard any indications of pressure being put on the pilots to go.
Yeah, we've talked about that in the past, not only with business aviation or charter operators. There was an accident out here in Aspen, Colorado years ago, where unfortunately it was a Gulfstream 3 that was going into Aspen. The charter customer on that particular airplane was actually sitting in the jump seat in the cockpit and basically told the crew, I'm paying for this flight. We're going to Aspen, even though the weather in Aspen really wasn't conducive for them to continue the approach and landing. There was a lot of pressure put on this flight crew to accomplish the mission in Aspen and not go to the alternate. Unfortunately, that resulted in a catastrophic accident that killed 15 passengers and 3 crew members because of poor decision making, because of a lack of operational discipline. And you bring up a good point, and that is, was there pressure put on this crew under these extreme weather conditions when no one else was flying to, again, get out of the airport and continue the mission?
So, and it also extends to the pilots. Sometimes there's self-imposed pressure. You know, they have a slot in Europe. Not many of the airports in Europe require you to have a slot to land. And maybe they were running out of time for the slot that they had in certain airports. And you just can't call up and get another slot. Sometimes you have to wait several days. And a friend of mine that was went over to Italy about a year ago, and he had a rare slot to land in Naples, and he missed it, and he had to land in Rome and drive down to Naples and drive back to meet the airplane because he couldn't get in it because he missed his slot. So that's pressure that's put on the pilots. It can be self-imposed pressure because he hears what his passengers are going for as well. Maybe they were going for a business meeting that they were late for already.
Yeah.
Right. So, and he's trying to accommodate. There's lots of pieces to the pressure puzzle. And the NTSB is attuned to those. They do pay attention to all of that with the human factors program that they have, which is pretty robust. So we'll have to wait and see what they get out of that. But that is going to be a big concern.
And again, we've seen this both in the commercial airline side of the house, as well as business and charter operators, even, you know, Part 91 private owners and operators, because again, you have that meeting slot over in Europe. You've got a major snowstorm. You don't know if you're going to be snowed in for 4 hours or 4 days. And again, maybe they were trying to beat the weather. So between the pilots trying to get out of there before it really got bad, or being pressured to get out of there before it really got bad, that has really got to be dissected, because again, we're always talking about operational discipline. The final authority to make that airplane go safely is the flight crew, and i.e. the captain, the pilot in command. And these are all the influential pieces of a probable cause with contributing factors that can lead not only to the basis of safety recommendations, but more or less the lessons learned that can be put back into the system for other operators. Because again, we are not inventing new ways to cause accidents. And again, we've talked about this, not only with the airplane and its icing issues, but also foul weather. You look at Palm 90, if we go back, way back to Air Florida, Palm 90, where you had a Miami-based crew, if you will, had rarely flown into weather conditions like existed in Washington on that particular day. The de-icing process was suspect. And then they took off with not only a contaminated wing airplane, but they also had a fouled engine. So they weren't really producing full takeoff thrust by erroneous indications. So there are so many issues that need to be developed during the course of an investigation like this to see whether or not they're isolated events or contributory because they are linked together.
Right. And we didn't even mention the problem with engines. Also, if there was accumulated snow on the wings, those rear-mounted engines at liftoff will suck the snow right off the wing. And it could, in extreme cases, actually flame the engines out, shut them down.
Yeah. And so, and again, that, I mean, again, that's another great point, given the fact that they really never made it past the airport boundary. And the concern is that this airplane apparently got airborne, because the pictures that are circulating on the internet show the aircraft totally inverted with the occupiable space of the cabin completely crushed, which presumably has led to the fatalities and the serious injury. So the airplane had to have gotten airborne, so they may have had at least sufficient thrust to at least get airborne. But with a contaminated wing, if you have a stall right after liftoff, the airplane starts to roll uncontrollably. Now all of a sudden you have a loss of control, but there are a lot of factors that led to that loss of control. You just can't use the blanket term loss of control.
So in listening to some of the information on the internet this morning, all the instant experts that know everything about every plane crash there ever is, they're already speculating on what's going on. But really, we just laid out a whole number of facts that have to be asked, answered, and analyzed before you can make any decision on whether or not they played a role in the accident. Yeah. Remember, most accidents are a chain of events. You know, and I like to, in my presentations, I always cite ValuJet. There was 8 places in the ValuJet hearing where if one employee had done their job, that accident wouldn't have happened. 8 different employees just were careless with their job and killed everybody on that airplane.
Yeah. And again, when we talk about these types of accidents so early on, we can point out the obvious issues. But the whole purpose of the investigation is to develop the backstory, because there's always a basis of knowledge that you're not going to have, you know, just looking at a picture on the internet or getting bits and pieces of maybe factual, maybe not factual information, and then trying to build a storyline with it. So again, while early speculation is the obvious, yeah, there was lousy weather conditions. Yeah, there was snow. Yeah, there was ice. Yeah, there could have been a contaminated airplane, contaminated runway. Those are the obvious things. But the whole purpose of the investigation is to develop those things that aren't so obvious that either contributed or caused this accident. We always appreciate your feedback. We always entertain trying to incorporate some of that feedback either into future shows with accidents and incidents that you'd like to hear about, or you want to get more information about the things that we've talked about. So you can email us at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. We try to answer every one of your emails. We enjoy the feedback, good, bad, or indifferent, because we always want to make this show better. So if you have any comments, any questions, please don't hesitate. flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com is your direct link to myself, John, and our missing in action partner, Todd. So,
yes. And we try to answer them. I pop them up when I have a free moment and answer the emails directly often.
So with that, John, given the fact that we are in winter flying season, we've been through a number of accidents. You and I have worked together on a number of winter-related accidents. One of the more prominent accidents that I was the investigator in charge of was an accident involving an ATR-72 that crashed in Roselawn, Indiana, back in 1994. That particular accident, we learned a lot about airframe icing, its dramatic effects, freezing rain, freezing drizzle, which we know we had some of that up and down the East Coast, mixed with the sleet and that kind of thing. It's a great report to read. Go on the NTSB website, pull it down if you really want to understand winter operations with not only large aircraft, but everything that is in that report really applies also to general aviation airplanes, all the way down to a 172 that is not certified for flight into known icing. But you can learn a lot about the as a pilot, really dissecting the weather. So we have a lot of winter operation discussions right now because we are in the midst of that season. So with that, John, I will leave you with our last word.
Well, before I even get to my last word, on that ATR accident, right, there's one of the things that we discovered in the course of that investigation was the fact that the manufacturer had a lot of the knowledge about the circumstances that we had to go discover while we were conducting tests. But they had put that information in their magazine. And the difference in culture between pilots and operators in Europe and those in the United States, those magazines were mandatory reading by pilots that flew that airplane in Europe. and that they were the cautions and they were the information in that magazines that they put out quarterly about the flying in winter weather. But here in the United States, they sent the magazines. The magazines, you could find them in the operator's office on the coffee room, coffee tables, but they never distributed them to the pilots, and the pilots had no requirement to read them.
And the other thing is that the information that was published in these magazines wasn't published in the flight manuals or the AFMs,
right.
Or even in their FOM, their flight operations manual on how the airplane should be operated. And like you said, John, it wasn't required reading. Now, there are some carriers around the world that do have, you know, you have to read and then sign that you have read this information. But this was not mandated in this particular instance, and there was some very good information. And when we were doing that accident investigation and we were doing the public hearing, the French tried to convince us that, hey, we published this, you know, we distributed it. Yeah, but it wasn't in a formal mandatory way so that you knew that all pilots or all operators of these aircraft did get that information. It was a hit or miss thing.
So that is in part why we do what we do on this show. We don't just read the accident reports. Where we can, we try to go in a little deeper to give you the backstories, to give you the additional facts so that you can be aware of what happens and what's going on and what you can do to protect yourself.
Yeah.
So that's the whole basis of this show. I don't know. I know Greg and I, we're sick of picking up people in bodies. It hurts to pick up broken airplanes. You can imagine how much it hurts to pick up broken people. And both of us have done far too much of that.
So we encourage you to go beyond. That is, it's obvious that, you know, as a pilot, as an operator, you have a high level of knowledge. But, you know, the proverbial, the cliche, you know, you have a pilot's license, that's a license to learn. It absolutely is. In the role that I play with John as expert witnesses in the work that we do and the work that we have done in our government roles, you always have to educate yourself on things that are out of your comfort zone that you really don't have a good fundamental understanding of. But that's the challenge. But it's also what keeps you ahead of the game because it expands that basis of knowledge because you just don't know when you're going to need some information that you may have read in an article or through a NASA publication that you just happened to find on the internet about in-flight icing and that kind of stuff. That information is going to be valuable to you because you inadvertently get into a situation where you get an icing event or something to that effect. So definitely take that challenge, go beyond the obvious, go beyond your comfort zone, and continue to learn, especially with winter ops. So with that, John, I will leave you with our last word.
So if you're going to go flying, decision-making is very, very important in this process. Do a good pre-planning of your trip from the hotel before you go to the airport. Do it again at the airport. If they don't agree, dig in deep and find out why. When you get out to your airplane, do a good pre-flight. Greg and I just spent an evening talking to two young pilots in emerging operations, and we talked about how they train their pilots to do a pre-flight. And I was impressed with one, made sure that the pilots knew what a cotter pin was, knew what a castellated nut was, knew how to look at them to make sure that they were there and doing their you know, castellated nuts are always on critical components because they don't come loose. So they are the most important fastener that you can have. They're always on flight controls, right? So knowing what to look for is very important. And after you get in your airplane, pay attention on your taxi. I just was reviewing page after page after page of taxi accidents just this year. And running over taxiway and runway lights, high on the list, off into the weeds because they were programming something. And listen, do one job at a time. Don't multitask because that means you're just doing two jobs lousy. And when you get in the air, put that head on a swivel. We've got so many young, not so young even, new pilots up there today. And we know they're going to make mistakes. Don't become part of their mistake. Put your head on a swivel and pay attention to what's going on around you. And please, please fly safely.
And if you want to become a VIP member of the Flight Safety Detectives, look for that on the YouTube membership. Again, you're going to get premium content. We're going to be expanding that. And with your feedback, that makes this show better. So definitely become a VIP member through YouTube. And thanks again for watching our show.
Fly safe. Our coach didn't interrupt us at all.
I was looking at him lovingly.